distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, we could almost put Arizona in here. America today is ready to throw off the old shackles of regimentation and red tape. America today is ready, willing, and more than able to speak up for individual initiative, individual dignity, and individual responsibility. And even Democrats know that there's such a mood in this country of ours. In fact, I've heard some Democrats lately who've been trying to sound more like Republicans than some Republicans I know. And this party of ours is the majority party when it comes to this nation's real needs, real hopes, and its deep, vital spirit. This is a can-do party. It's a can-win party. And I needn't remind you, it is a will-win party in 1964. And I look forward to campaigning and campaigning with every ounce of my energy and strength for the finest Republican candidates ever to go before the people of this nation. This is a Republican year for a dedicated, and remember this, a united Republican Party. Now, as I look around this vast crowd, as I look over crowds in America from small gatherings to immense gatherings, I'm very, very pleased, as are all Republicans, to notice the preponderance of young faces in the audience. This is a real thrill. And I can say, having visited with literally hundreds of thousands, probably millions of young people, having raised four of my own, that this isn't a fearful generation that we have to reach. This is a generation of hope and courage. This is a generation that wants the chance, just the chance, to solve some of the problems which government mismanagement has created in America. This is a generation in particular that wants to get on with the business of building a free and a peaceful world. Now, we've been frustrated in this country through 3 years of indecision. Freedom, which under Dwight Eisenhower was a crusade, has become a wholly negotiable stack of chips in a game of political expediency. We now have a president who tries to save money by turning off lights in the White House. At the same time, he's heading toward a staggering addition to the national debt. I suggested the other day that we ought to call him Light Bulb Johnson. And that we turn him off in 1964. This same president is turning off lights, lights of leadership, lights of conscience, lights of honesty, and lights of strength and courage. Where, I ask tonight, is the bright light of an American statement that can outshine Khrushchev's boast that our grandchildren will live under communism? Where is the American statement that says, for all the world to hear and believe, that Khrushchev's children, our grandchildren, will live under freedom? Right. And the answer to that statement is just this, that it's in the Republican Party and its principles. It's in Republican leadership. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the essence of the choice we face. The choice, very simply, is tyranny or freedom, expediency or principle. That's what we're talking about. That's what this election is about. Now, there are those in America who criticize anyone who, as they put it, wraps himself in the American flag. Well, I would far rather wrap myself in that flag than in the shrouds of indecision and of defeat. I would rather see that flag flying proudly and respected than see it torn, flung down, and spat upon around this world. It's not international wisdom or patience that keeps turning the other cheek to every slap at freedom. Nor, may I remind you, is that the way to peace. There are no first-step compromises that lead to second-step hopes for peace. There are only little defeats that ultimately lead to major defeats. And what peace this troubled planet has ever known has come through the strength of men determined to keep the peace. And what peace we have in the world today, whether we like it or not, is the result of our strength and the strength of the free world. And what peace we can hope for tomorrow, again, whether we like it or not, will come the same way. The one and the only one sure way to prevent war in our time is to make sure that communism knows it cannot win a war if it starts one. Now, one necessity is to maintain our armed superiority over communism. Ladies and gentlemen, we have such superiority today thanks to programs which were initiated under Dwight Eisenhower. This administration hasn't introduced a single new major strategic weapon system. Furthermore, this administration is pursuing a defense policy which will, in effect, place all of our eggs in the intercontinental ballistic missile basket. This is a dangerous course because most of our outstanding military leaders say that this is a dangerous course. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I may be a little bit unusual in this, but when it comes to weapons and the defense of this nation, I would far rather trust the experienced judgment of a General LeMay than the political decisions and computer exercises of a Robert McNamara. Let's take a look at what Lyndon Johnson, Secretary of Defense, is saying in the same testimony. Oh, he repeats his personal attacks against me, but he offers no new facts. He just offers repeated insults. And why? Because I have questioned the reliability of intercontinental ballistic missiles as part of my plea for the maintenance of a proven and flexible United States Defense Force. And this administration knows, and I know, and the Soviet Union knows, that the ultimate reliability of our ICBMs is based upon theory, and theory alone, not upon practice and not upon testing. Yet, ladies and gentlemen, it's upon those weapon systems that this administration is willing to stake the life of the nation. And I say that drawing board reliability is not enough upon which to stake the life of this nation and the future of freedom. And I'm not alone, nor will all of the personal attacks that this administration can launch disprove one word of what I've said and will say or add one bit to the defense of this nation. I remain seriously concerned about the reliability of our ICBMs and, just as importantly, about the necessity of maintaining a balanced, flexible, and modern defense. We will face a deterrent gap through which the full force of advanced Soviet weapons could be felt. And we will face the terrible day when our ability to deter war by the preponderance of our power would be nothing nothing but a paper wall. And I suggest tonight that it should be a prime responsibility of a president of the United States to increase our power so long as we are threatened, to increase our power just exactly as the Russians are doing. I charge again tonight that this administration, instead of doing this, is letting our power lag and slide. And I pledge that the immediate and full restoration of our defenses would be one of my first acts as President of our United States. In fact, today, we have in our own strength and in the strength of the whole free world, the lever with which to move history. It's not our armed strength alone that gives us that lever, although if the day ever comes when we lack that strength and yet are still opposed by an enemy such as communism, history will move us onto its scrap pile. No, the arsenal of our strength, the strength that can oppose, can halt, and roll back communism is immense. It's almost endless. It offers the way to victory without war, to peace, without the sacrifice of freedom or justice. Let me inventory for you some of the strength in this arsenal of which I speak. First, we have economic strength. The free world's economy is a colossus compared with the collectivist claptrap of communism. If our goal could be to apply that economy as a force against communism rather than as a support for communism, we might see in our lifetime the collapse of a system that can't even feed its own people and certainly can't forever fool them. And next, we have the power of our ideas. The free world's psychological strength is a mighty fortress because of this. That of communism is only a house of cards. Give a free man the freedom to think, and ideas will never fail. But deprive him of freedom and tell him he can't think and can't speak, then we lose one of our great psychological weapons, which is the West's almost unlimited ability to outthink the rest of the world and to outact them when they want to. Now, if our goal could be to apply our psychological force, rather than forever apologizing for it, we might, in our time, strip away the mask of legitimacy from the fraudulent regime and the foolish philosophy of communism. And there's another great strength, let me remind you, in our alliances and institutions. The free world's political strength is gigantic, but its muscles grow flabby from disuse and misuse. They must be exercised. When they're not, communism's fear-driven machine wins without resistance and is encouraged to excesses. Oh, the list is as endless as the diversity of free men and free institutions. The opportunities are as endless as the dedication of free men. I'm charged with being reckless because I happen to believe in the Eisenhower Dulles foreign policy. I've been accused of being a warmonger. I'm a peacemonger, probably the best one you ever ran into. I just ask this question of those people here and those listening. Is it reckless to talk this way of winning the Cold War? Is it reckless to say that we risk war less through strength than through weakness? Is it reckless to say that this generation can be the first in a new era of freedom rather than the next to last gasp of a worn-out world, no longer ready to work to strive, to dedicate itself to freedom. The truly reckless leadership in such a world as ours today is the laggard leadership that shrinks from decision, that confuses comfort and conscience, that buys time and votes with the fate of the entire free world. Our generation, our nation, was not born to sit in an easy chair silence. The umbrella of false security is not the symbol we deserve. The plea of don't rock the boat is not the slogan that you and I deserve. Either we seek the victory of freedom, the peace of freedom, or we are not worthy of the name American. I implore all of those who are concerned, ask of the men who propose themselves for the responsibility of foreign policy formulation, ask of them one single question. Ask what they think of communism. Ask what they think of the profound crisis of the soul which produced it. Ask whether they are prepared to come to terms with it, or whether concretely they would oppose it. Ladies and gentlemen, ask and demand an answer to that, for that is the question of war and peace in our time. It will be the question tomorrow. It will be the question before November. It will be the question after November. There's no quick end to the Cold War. There's no quick end to communism. It requires the dedication of every living free man in this world, because communism is an idea. And you don't stamp ideas out with bombs and bullets. You stamp ideas out with better ideas. And our ideas are better ones. No, it's the direction, the decision that becomes important. The first step that's crucial. Either we start the march or we abandon it, as we've been abandoning it, resting on our laurels, hoping for miraculous signs of friendship from a foe that has sworn the destruction of our society. And I have yet to hear one leader of the communist world change that plan, say that they are softening, that we can live together. They're spending more money on defense than they've ever spent. They're developing new aircraft. They're developing anti-ballistic missiles. They're developing weapons that we're not developing. And yet some of us, some people who live in our midst, learned men, are seeing weakness in the communists, seeing a softening of the bear's claws so that we might live in the same cage. As long as that bear, as long as that philosophy is bent upon destroying the freedom of the world, then free people have to stay alert, whether we like it or not. Now again, I'm told that talking this way is unpopular. It's too grim. It's too tough. It's too much trouble to think about. We didn't ask for the responsibility. We don't seek the mission. We want to rest, to relax, call a truce, to take a holiday. Now, ladies and gentlemen, I didn't get into politics to relax. And I wasn't born in this land to follow the leader or abandon my conscience. I won't run that way. I can't live that way. When we are faced with a material threat of arms, it is foolish, it is weak, it is almost stupid for us to talk as if communism were no longer interested in overthrowing freedom. It's crazy, it's dangerous for us to be unilaterally disarming ourselves at a time when the enemy is arming himself. Now, It's unknowing for those amongst us to say that this kind of talk leads to war. What happened in the Straits of Formosa when Eisenhower stood up to the Chinese Reds? We didn't come close to war. We came pretty close to peace. What happened when the Marines landed at Lebanon? Did we go to war? No. Peace was just a little closer. And when President Kennedy blockaded Cuba and forced the removal of at least some of the missiles and some of the men, did we come close to a war? No. We came close to peace. Every time a great nation, charged as we're charged, has a responsibility of being great, with the job of keeping the peace, every time a nation like ourselves confronted with these problems presents a strong position to the whole world so that our enemies and our friends know just how far we will be pushed, peace will live in the world and give us the time that you and I and our children need to start living as if we believe that our freedoms came from God. Thank you.